For this evening, we've been doing these occasional or semi-regular teachings on metta meditation, and gradually going through the different stages. And somewhat to my regret, we haven't been able to be as consistent as I would have liked, but what I'd like to talk about for this week is the second stage of metta, the development of the second stage. Metta for a loved person. So we do this when the first stage, metta for the first person, is complete. And it's complete when we've develop the feeling of metta, roused it up, developed it, soaked it through our whole body. And when that feeling has become steady and even for at least a reasonable period of time, at least 10, 20 minutes or so, until it feels like it's fairly much there, fairly present, we're fairly comfortable with that. It's not just coming or going. We're quite comfortable and it's quite present. And so when we feel good about that, and then we can move on to the second person, and the loved person, and we should choose somebody who it's very easy for us to have kind thoughts about, and somebody for whom we have a simple and childlike love for. It's important that the second person not be somebody who we have a complicated love-hate relationship with. It shouldn't be anybody who we might find sexually attractive. Nor should it be somebody who's passed away, because the memory of the departed might bring with it thoughts of grief. Practically, it's usually best to, the second stage, unless you're very blessed to have very unusually simple and straightforward relationships with people, it's usually best to choose somebody who's not kind of one of the closest people to you, but someone who's a little bit less close. So for example, maybe like grandchildren rather than children, or grandparents, somebody like that. Somebody who, you can just have, you don't have to have a realistic relationship with them. It doesn't have to be a mature relationship, but just a very simple childlike relationship. This is what we're looking for. So it doesn't matter, it also doesn't matter what is the depth of that love that you feel. It can be quite shallow. It doesn't have to be somebody who you think of a lot or who's very important in your life. It might be just, say, a nephew or a niece who you only see very occasionally, very rarely, but still you have a soft spot for them. So again, it's the purity and the simplicity of the metta which is important. And when we're developing that stage, we don't change anything, don't shift the mind or do anything different. Keep the mind still, keep the mind focused on the whole body awareness. And simply use the name of the person, the second person in the phrase of metta that we're reciting. So if you choose your father, then you say, may my father be happy, or whoever you've chosen. So don't, it's important to not move your mind out from your body and go over to where that person is. Because that's two places, isn't it? There's one place here and another place over there. That's two. We're not trying to develop two-pointedness of mind. We're trying to develop one-pointedness of mind. So keep the mind focused inside the body as concretely as possible. And as I mentioned a little while ago, that if you're having difficulty grounding, feeling a metta in the body, then start out by using the contemplation of a skeleton to really ground the mind inside the body. There's no need, when you're doing that meditation, to imagine that person. Okay, there's no need to conjure up an image of them. Of course it happens quite naturally that the image of that person will come up from time to time. So just don't worry about it, don't pay attention to it. Just keep on bringing the mind back to the feeling, remembering that the feeling is the meditation, not the picture of that person. The, what they call the near enemy on this particular stage in metta is desire, sexual desire. And both sexual desire and also and love, through metta, they have a similar characteristic in that they both see the positive side. They only want to see what's good about that other person. They're both very effective at erasing the faults and the blemishes in others. And so, of course, it's very normal that these things become very confused in our minds, and of course, this is how we normalize these relationships in our society, isn't it? That if we're in love with somebody, then that somebody's both a sexual partner, but also somebody who we have a very kind of strong, what we imagine or what we often think of as the strongest emotional care and concern for. Of course, in the real world, it very often, these things don't go together. Yeah? So people have sexual relations without having any feeling of love or care for the person they're with. Or on the other hand, people quite frequently have a great deal of love and concern and care for others without there being any particular sexual component there. So these things are very commonly found separate. But nevertheless, in meditation, they can become confused and the mind can delude itself. So this is why it's important to be careful about this and remember that there are many cautionary tales of monks who've gone to cemeteries to watch decomposing corpses and then found themselves being aroused by the corpse and they're supposed to be causing disgust in them. So the mind is very tricky. So don't underestimate the trickiness of the mind. So this is why it's always so important in this to just make sure that we choose someone who, you know, we just really couldn't possibly have any sexual feelings for at all. Keep it really clear. This whole meditation system is designed very carefully and very deliberately to create the optimum conditions for developing metta to a profound level that can be used as a basis for seriously deep meditation. And so the way that we do it is not the same as how we normally develop metta, the way that these things happen in the ordinary world, where it's always messy and confused and there's always conflicting emotions and so on. In metta, we try to exclude as many of those other conditions as possible and just focus on the development of that one emotion as purely and as simply as possible. The other problem that sometimes you find at that stage is that when they're thinking of the loved person, usually you'll find that in doing the metta for the loved person, that the mind wants to think about them. So you like to think of the loved person, you like to turn your mind towards them, and so usually that meditation proceeds quite well. And as long as the main problems people have is if they're not grounded enough in their own body, then they keep on splitting off and going over there to where that person is. So this is one problem that you find. So you need to make sure we ground mindfulness in the body. The other problem, which is a more kind of subtle thing, is that we find the thoughts that come up about that person can turn to or can sort of twist into thoughts about what that person can do for you. Even if it's not as, you know, obvious as sexual thoughts, then, you know, maybe something that you know, some favor they can do for you or something they can give you or something like that. And so, of course, this is, you know, that when we're doing that, we're seeing this nature of relationships that we have, isn't it? That even with the best relationships with those we really love, that there's some selfishness there. It's not really pure. That there's a sense in which actually we love them because we love what they can do for us, what they can give us. So to that extent, that is not like a true metta. That's a corrupted metta. It's a love based on getting rather than on giving. So, as that meditation continues and mind stays focused on the loved person, then we want to keep an eye out for how that may change or develop or differ from how it felt when developing metta for oneself. So this is not something, you know, you shouldn't be kind of reflecting about this or worrying about it during the meditation itself, but you're just noticing the changes. That's all. It's just a matter of noticing. Ideally, we reach a stage where both of them are the same, where the mind keeps going with the same, more or less the same level or depth of metta. If metta for the loved person becomes weaker or perhaps even stronger than for oneself, then this is often not something that you'll notice immediately. It's not like as soon as you start doing it, then the metta itself will change. When we're developing the nimitta, because of the consistency of the vitaka vichara that we're using, using the words of metta, applying the mind, then it has its own momentum. It doesn't change so drastically and so quickly. This is one of the aspects of the growing sense of one-pointedness in the mind, unification. So when we go to the second stage, then there may be a sort of a different quality of metta for the loved one than for oneself. And that may take some time to really show itself, to gradually show over a few minutes. And the ideal is that they're the same. Okay, so the ideal is that metta for the loved one is the same as the metta for oneself, and that you're not going to observe any significant differences. Having said which, it's also true that generally, because you're continuing to sit, and if the meditation is going well, then the samadhi will become deeper and deeper. So you may find there's one aspect is just the natural progression of samadhi as it gets deeper and deeper through the stages of meditation. And the other thing is the relative strength of metta at the different stages. So just notice that. Now, some people find that it's much easier to develop metta for the second person than for the first person. That is, they can love others, but they can't love themselves. And of course, in that lies a whole story, doesn't it? A whole story, and a whole probably fairly painful story. It's not a healthy way to be, but unfortunately, seems to be our culture promotes that for some reason. So if you're finding it difficult or impossible to do the metta, develop metta for oneself, then just don't worry about it. Yeah, just start with the second stage, do metta for the loved one, and do that as strong and as well as you can, developing that just as you I described for the first person, develop the metta for the second person, and then when that's full and complete, then bring it back to the first person. Okay, so you can do it either way around, but try doing it for the first person first, and you know, if you've given that a good shot and it's just really not happening for you, then have a go at doing the second person. But at the end of the day, the result should be the same, that metta for the first and the second person, for oneself and for the loved one, should be the same. That's what we're aiming for. Generally speaking, it's if we've completed the first stage fairly well, then most of the time it's not actually all that difficult to do the second stage. It follows on fairly naturally, and usually the feeling of metta continues, it flows on without too much problem. Actually, the really difficult stages in this practice are the first stage, just developing and getting the metta going in the first place, and also the fourth stage is very difficult. So for the most part, then that second stage should be not too difficult if the first stage is okay. And so just be patient with that, just sort of stay with that and develop it. So if you're talking about doing one sitting, then do the first stage until you feel that's as developed as it should be, and then try the second stage. If the second stage weakens or falls down, then just come back to the first stage and keep on developing it, building it up and building it up again. If the second stage remains steady and goes well, then just keep on developing that, keep on making it more and more stable. Don't be in a rush to go and develop the higher stages of meditation. Okay, just be very, very patient. The more that you're patient in the early stages, the more that you just keep on perfecting those skills in meditation, then the easier and more that it will flow later on. And the more stable it will be, the more resilient. So where the resilience comes from is from developing those basic skills. One other practical consideration is that we should always choose the person for each of these stages before we start meditating. Okay, so don't get to finish the first stage and then think, oh, well, that's good, maybe I'll try the second stage. I wonder who I should do metta for now. Should I do it for Dad? Oh no, hang on, I had an argument with him last week. Maybe better do it for... Okay, so make sure you've chosen it beforehand. You know who you're going to be doing it for. It doesn't always have to be the same person, but it should be only one person each meditation. Okay, so you don't make a list of all the people that you love and do each one of them. Just one person. If you want to do metta for all your other loved ones and family and so on, then do that at the end of the meditation. And you can just think of all of those and send metta out to them and so on. If we do it in the meditation itself, then it just becomes another distraction, another complication. That's what we're trying to leave behind. So don't worry yourself with the thought, are they going to feel it? Are they going to really get this? Is this like a zapper metta ray I can send over to them and they can actually feel it? So that's not an important question. The important question is how we can develop our own heart. If they feel it, they feel it. If they don't, they don't. There's nothing much we can do about that. It's not about learning how to zap others. It's about developing our own heart. Okay, so let's do some guided meditation and let's see how we can develop in our experience that second stage. Sitting quietly. Resting the mind in silence. Clearly knowing, clearly aware. say to oneself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Repeating those words again and again and again. Saying the words evenly, steadily. Using the words to make up. Firm. Solid foundation for the mind. And then noticing that little light that just turns on when we're not looking. That light that comes with it, love, forgiveness, acceptance. Whenever the mind wanders, just gently bring it back, keeping it steady and safe. In that gentle ocean of loving kindness. In the metta through the whole body until we can feel the mind sitting here, being aware of the whole body. Image in our mind of our whole body filled with loving kindness. then when that feels complete, moving to the second stage, metta for the loved one. Keeping the mind exactly as it is. Not moving or changing anything. Now coming near the end of the meditation, from that loved person coming back to oneself, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away, and allowing the mind to return to a neutral space, emptying, open and clear. With the mind clear, just take a minute to reflect on how that meditation has gone, inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? How did my mind change? How did I approach the meditation? What worked? What didn't work? What was helpful? What was obstructive? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu. So I've already been talking for quite a while, so I don't think I'll give much of it more of a talk this evening, but I just wanted to briefly just remind us all of one important Dhamma framework that I think is important to remember at this stage of the retreat, and that's the five hindrances. Sense, desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse and doubt. And this is one of those very central, very important teachings which we should all be intimately familiar with. And I'm sure most of us are very intimately familiar with these hindrances. But I don't just mean hindrances themselves, but also the teaching about them. We should know that very well. And we should all be familiar with the basic facts and skills around these particular states of mind. And as we know, the Buddha said that the hindrance of sense desire is counteracted by especially contemplation of the body. So understanding, looking at our own body, looking at our own skeleton, different parts of the body, elements and so on. And then by that means we realize that there's actually nothing to get excited about. It's just skin and bones. And it's such a curious thing that you can see this fascination we have around the body, that this is always this kind of closeness of desire and disgust, that it's the human body is the thing that we feel the most attraction towards, but also, you know, if we dismember it, then it's the most horrifying and disgusting thing. We can walk past a butcher's shop and see lumps of meat sitting there and We usually don't have too much of an emotional reaction. We're kind of used to seeing that. But if somebody were to tell us that they're lumps of human flesh sitting there in the butcher's shop, I don't know how you'd feel, but certainly you'd feel something. So it's this curious way that desire works. So it's important to understand that and so on. Understand that it comes in subtle forms and coarse forms, and to know the difference. Like with all of these hindrances, actually, you know, the basic antidote to the hindrances is simply your ordinary practice. So you don't have to sort of do special practices to address every particular hindrance that arises. You know, just the general practice, starting with the sila, the right view, practice of restraint, practice of mindfulness, all of these things. And the meditation, the Buddha said that watching your breath, anapanasati, then the hindrances will scatter in front of it like leaves being blown in the wind. And so just those ordinary practices, which are the substance of our monastic life, these things themselves will work to get rid of all these hindrances in all kinds of different ways. And if we like, we can go through and analyze the different contributions that different practices will have in overcoming particular hindrances. So normally, if we have hindrances that arise in our meditation of one form or another, normally we don't really have to do too much about it except recognize that the hindrance is there and just come back to our basic meditation. It's only if the hindrance becomes strong and we can't abandon it like that we need to turn more attention to it and introduce some more specific measures to overcome those specific problems. So it's not something you don't kind of get worried about it just because you have a thought of desire or something like that. It's very normal. Yeah, that always happens. Unless you're an anagami, it's going to happen. So, but you know the difference. There's a difference between, you know, having a thought of desire or something like that and then the mind being consumed with desire. So we understand, mindfulness understands, notices the difference. Wisdom understands the implications of that difference, and the energy comes into play to overcome that. Ill will is the second hindrance, anger, annoyance, grudge, all of these things, jealousy. So this is like the counterpart. And desire and hatred always go together. And so whenever you see strong desire, then there's always a flip side of anger. If you see anger, there's always a flip side of desire there somewhere as well. So of course the antidote to ill will is loving kindness and doing metta, and also similar meditations that are very positive. Any kind of positive emotional meditation is especially useful for overcoming anger. Which is not to say that metta or these other practices only overcome ill will. Of course, they'll overcome all the hindrances, but the special one that they overcome, that they focus on, is overcoming anger. Sultan torpor as a hindrance is on the side of ignorance. It's where the mind doesn't want to know, it wants to turn off. And doesn't want to pay attention, doesn't want to make an effort. So there's something, I think, which is deep inside us, which really regrets that we ever heard about the Dhamma in the first place. Isn't it? It's kind of nicer to get through life just not knowing, you know. Just waft through in blissful ignorance. So this is like the vibhava tanha, the kind of the negativity in the mind that wants to wants to not exist, just not be, just somehow just wants just to not be, get away from the problem. And so, of course, in coarse forms, this often torpor means, you know, just falling asleep and so on. But it also has much more, a more subtle meaning, and a more subtle meaning is where it's like a just an unwillingness to actually deal with or address our problems. So this is something which is a big deal in Buddhist practice, and a big deal in a monastery, that very often we simply don't want to deal with problems. We can't handle it, so we go away. Go and hide away in our kuti. And just pretend that the problems all live somewhere outside. Because we don't want to do the work and the great effort that it'll take to help us overcome them. So this sloth and torpor can manifest in lots of different ways. With some people it manifests as not meditating, too lazy to meditate. For other people it can manifest as meditating all day, because it's the easiest thing to do. You can just sit down and close your eyes and not do anything and boom, don't have to deal with anything. Next hindrance is restlessness and remorse. And these two are kind of, restlessness is future orientated and remorse is past orientated. So here we've got the future and the past idea. And of course, the remorse is like this active force in the mind that goes back and dredges up the past, brings it and applies it in the present. Restlessness is the mind that doesn't want to live in the present, but wants to rush off into the future, always going here and there. And the antidote to these, of course, is tranquility, samatha, anapanasati. Anything that can make us more content and happy in the present moment. And the final one of the hindrances is doubt, vichikicca. So doubt again being an aspect of delusion. Of course, doubt isn't always delusion and doubt isn't always wrong. The Buddha said that there are some things that we should doubt about. There are some things that are doubtful. And it's quite appropriate to doubt about them. But this is referring not to the genuine doubt about things that we should have doubt about. This is referring to just the a compulsion in the mind to just not accept things, to just keep on just not being sure, just not being able to trust. Even when we know. So the antidote to doubting is inquiry. Very important to remember that. The antidote to doubting is inquiry. Find out for yourself. And sometimes these doubts are, fairly simple things, surface things. We can answer it by looking it up in a book or just asking somebody what's the answer to this question. But the more important kind of doubts are not concrete in that way. They're intangible. Is this really working? Am I living my life the right way? Should I be doing this kind of meditation? What about if I did walking meditation now? Is that going to be better than sitting? Or maybe I've just been sitting for too long. Maybe I need to rest. So these kind of doubts that go through that don't really have an answer. And it's very important just to be able to accept that. This is one of the aspects of maturity, is to just understand that you just have to do it. You just have to make a decision. And there is no right and wrong very often. We just do the best we can. Is this particular meditation method the best one for you? Well, who knows? But just give it a go and try. how much of the day should I be meditating, how much should I be studying, how much should I be sitting, how much should I be walking, how much should I be chanting, how much should I be sleeping, how much should I be eating. There's no answers to these questions. That's just doubting. You just do the best you can. When you eat, eat to take the hunger away. When you sleep to take the tiredness away. If you're sitting meditation, do that to still your mind down. If you're walking meditation, you do that, you develop your mindfulness. If you want to study, then do study. Try to learn the Buddha's teachings. Whatever you're doing, just try to do that the best you can, and don't be always second guessing. Keep it simple. Don't second guess yourself. Don't be suspicious about yourself. If what you're doing is good, then just do it. So that's just a few thoughts on the five hindrances for this evening I just wanted to put out there. Okay, so let's finish up by paying respects to the Triple J.
Sangam namah.